Yeah. So we've been talking about the woman at the well, and this is talked about last week. I'm talking about this week, and Rob is going to talk about it the following week. And we've kind of taken different aspects and want to highlight different parts of this really exciting, wonderful story. And focus last week on who Jesus was, or who Jesus could be in the unfolding of this narrative for the woman, and how we found ourselves in the story as if we were the woman kind of approaching the well and getting into that situation. As we traveled with the woman, there was this man sitting there who asked her for a drink, and then she could tell he was a Jewish man who would go over the boundaries and talk to her, a Samaritan woman. And then he's a gift giver, as he says, I've got better water here, I've got living water. And then she recognizes he's a prophet, and at the end recognizes he's the Messiah. And I skipped over this very profound statement that Jesus makes. And that's in John 4, 21 to 23. And I'm going to read the whole question, because that shapes how we interact with this story and how we deal with this story. So John 4, 19 to 24. And that's just, didn't write down the page number. I had it last week. But. Sir, the woman said, you must be a prophet. So tell me why it is that you Jews insist that Jerusalem is the only place of worship, while we Samaritans claim it to be at Mount Gerizim, where our ancestors worshipped. Jesus replied, believe me, dear woman, the time is coming when it will no longer matter whether you worship the Father on this mountain or in Jerusalem. You Samaritans know very little about the one you worship, while we Jews know all about him, for salvation comes through the Jews. But the time is coming, indeed, it's here now, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The Father is looking for those who will worship him in that way. For God is spirit, so those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. So I'd like to fill in a couple points of context related to this story, and I did talk about them a little bit last week, but it's important to have refreshers and also for those who weren't here last week. And those who know me and have listened to me know I love context. And I was recently asked about the meaning of a verse, just a verse, and I said, well, you have to look at the context. And he said, oh, Chris, don't tell me about the context. And I said, it's all about context. So you'll have to labor here with me a little bit of context, a little bit of repetitiveness from last week. The Jews and Samaritans have had tension. Galilee was above, and then Samaria in the middle, and then Judea to the south. And then so if you're going from Galilee downwards to Jerusalem or vice versa, you'd have to go through Samaria. And they had numerous conflicts. And what surrounded this is that place of worship. The Samaritans viewed Mount Gerizim as the place of worship, the place where one would go to worship God. And this is due to their Old Testament, their scriptures, and that would only be the first five books of the Bible, Genesis through Deuteronomy. And in this, in the Ten Commandments, there's the commandment to worship only at Mount Gerizim. And so that's their focus, that's their idea, worship on this mountain. And we see for the Jewish tradition, you have David who longed to build the temple for his God, and then how that was fulfilled in Solomon, and how this settled in the place of Jerusalem where everybody could go to the temple of worship. And that theology fills out throughout the Old Testament. So that was the major tension point between the two people. The Jewish people viewed the Samaritans as an intermingled race, not as purely Jewish anymore. The Samaritans didn't view themselves in that way. They viewed themselves as coming a direct line from Jacob. And so this was numerous tensions related to this. And one doesn't have to think too or just think of the present situation where in the Middle East there's still this debate about the true place of worship or who has claim to Jerusalem, who has claim to that place of worship. And the tension was similar in Jesus' day between the Samaritans and the Jews. So this is surrounded what in Jesus' statement when he says, you worship what you don't know, but we worship what we do know, because salvation is from the Jews. They're saying, your story is incomplete because you only focus on these first five books of the Old Testament. You don't focus on the overall story, the complete revelation of God through the prophets and through the Psalms and through the scriptures. This is what he's alluding to. You have an incomplete picture of who God is. And then Jesus transitions, and it's interesting. He changes what her question is. She asks, where is the right place? Where is the right place to worship? And he changes the question and says that's not what it's about. It's not about where one worships. He says, believe you me, dear woman. And many translations just have, believe you me, woman. And the New Living Translation does well here to put dear woman in here, because it wasn't a term of looking down. It wasn't a derogatory statement. It was just a pleasantry. How we might say ma'am or sir in our culture, say a ma'am, it's if you don't know the person's name, or Mrs. or Miss. It's an appropriate term, a polite term in a conversation. It's a familiar term. So she says sir, he says ma'am. And then he says, believe me, dear woman, the time is coming when it will no longer matter whether you worship the Father on this mountain or in Jerusalem. Of course, this mountain being Gerizim, the mountain that Moses commanded in the Samaritan, in Scripture, the Samaritan Pentateuch to worship on. And Jerusalem, where David prepared the temple and Solomon completed it. And then we had Solomon's great prayer and the filling of the temple. And his answer is basically this, because I transcend both these characters. I'm greater than Moses. I'm greater than David. You must worship me, because I am the revelation of the Father. And this is the theology that fills out the rest of the Gospel of John, and even beforehand, that Jesus is saying, I am the true revelation of the Father, and that is who you worship. It's not about location. If you ever open up a restaurant or a business, and they say that the three rules are location, 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 and Jesus says, no, those aren't the three rules to worshiping God, to worshiping Yahweh. It's not location, location, location. It is worshiping in spirit and in truth. And it's interesting here, and I didn't catch this last week, is that she doesn't ask about whom to worship. She asks about where to worship. And that's probably because she thought that was a point of commonality between them. It was a point that they both worshiped Yahweh, the God who revealed himself to Moses and revealed himself to the Israelite people. But it's an interesting question to put out there, because even though they have this common ground of both worshiping Yahweh, the God who revealed himself to Moses, to Abraham in Genesis 12. I said Moses because that's where the name Yahweh is first given as a specific name. And because that's what the turning point is, because Jesus is saying, it's about worshiping the Father through me. It's about worshiping me as the revelation of who God is. So if we consider the context, we consider what's going on, we consider the question that she asks, the answer to spirit and truth becomes a statement where Jesus says, worship me because I am the true revelation of the Father. He says in verse 23 and 24, but the time is coming, indeed is here now, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The Father is looking for those who will worship him that way. For God is spirit, so those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. The first question I'd like to ask is, what time is it? And not just because we started a little late, and I know I was late the last couple weeks, and the people, and apparently there was pandemonium all broke loose in the last 10 minutes last week because I was a little late, so I felt a bit responsible for that. But what time it is related to the story. And the time for John is it's happening right now. It's the fulfillment of what we're hoping for, but it's happening right now. It's an exciting time. Indeed, it's here now. The phrase, the time is coming, indeed it is here now, is unique to John. He's the only one who uses this kind of phrase. If it's coming up and now it's actually here, the hope of things is present. It's in this time right now. And for the woman of the well, the meeting of this man, this Jesus, this Messiah, is the breaking forth of everything that she'd hoped for and the questions that she asked. Taking the answer that the time is now. I am the true revelation of the Father. I'm the one who's come to reveal all things. So spirit, I'd like to look at just a little bit of how spirit's used. And it's a major theme in John. It's used th- three times in Jesus' answer right here in John 4, in these few verses. And the Gospel of John uses spirit in a few different ways. You can use the soul of a person, picking up on the Hebrew concept of nefesh, the very inner person. And also, it's also used as wind in the Gospel of John. And then it's used as the Spirit of God or the Holy Spirit. These are kind of three general categories in how John uses the term. And I think I'd like to look at the story briefly that comes before, or a little bit before this, in John 3. And this is Nicodemus, who was a teacher, an official in the Jewish leaders. And he comes similarly to the woman at a time when he wouldn't be recognized. I talked about drawing water at midday. Well, Nicodemus comes late at night so nobody sees him. He comes. He wants it to be a secret meeting. He doesn't want people to know that he's coming to ask Jesus something. But actually, he doesn't actually ask Jesus something. He just comes, and Jesus just gives him an answer to the question he never asked. And Jesus answers in this, "You must be born again," which is what most evangelicals term the decision to join God's family, this born-again idea. And Nicodemus doesn't understand what Jesus is saying. So Jesus says, "How, if you're a teacher, how do you not know what's going on here?" And the question that Jesus answers that Nicodemus never asks is, who are God's people? Who is in and who is out? The Jewish people had what they considered the birthright of God. And this is one of the points that I mentioned of contention between the Samaritans and the Jews. The Jews believed that that the Samaritans were no longer part of the true people of God. And so Jesus answers Nicodemus, saying that the chosen people, the ones who have the promise of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are the ones who are born of spirit and water, and that you must identify yourselves as following after me, as one being born of the Spirit, if you want to be part of God's family. It's not about being born Jewish. It's about following after God, following after God through following Jesus and following him in stealing from the next story, in spirit and in truth. Those are the true followers of Jesus, is following after the one who is the true representation of the Father, Jesus. We never hear how Nicodemus responds in this story. This story just kind of, Jesus talks and has this long soliloquy, and then Nicodemus is never says what happens to him. But we do know that he comes up in two other incidences in the Gospel of John. And it's in chapter 7, verse 50, when he seemingly defends Jesus and says, how can a man be judged without having a trial, without hearing him out? And it seems like Nicodemus wants to hear more, and maybe even picking up on this conversation that he had with Jesus in John 3, saying, I want to hear more, I want to understand more. And we do know in chapter 19, verse 39, that Nicodemus is involved in the helping of taking Jesus off the cross and burying him in the tomb. And this would have clearly shown that he was and identified himself as a follower of Jesus, perhaps perplexed again and confused like the other disciples during from the time that Jesus died until Easter morning and then a little bit thereafter as well. But what's interesting is in John 3, we have this statement of the Son of Man being lifted up. And it's really interesting that Nicodemus hears this, the Son of Man being lifted up, and then Nicodemus is one of them who takes down the Son of Man and prepares him for burial, which is another little interconnectedness. So why this detour? And the answer to the question is, I think the way that Jesus responds to Nicodemus' presence, or Nicodemus being there, of saying, it's not about the birthright, it's about following after me, it's about worshiping me, is how Jesus states to the woman here in John 4 about worshiping in spirit and in truth. It's about being true worshipers. It's not about identifying oneself as Samaritan or Jewish or whatever. It's about following after God. It's about living a life that follows after Jesus. It's about worshiping in spirit and in truth. So this using of spirit twice in these two contexts, I think, links the two passages, links the two answers, links the two stories, where Jesus offers this opportunity to Nicodemus, who would be considered one, who was one of the religious officials, who would have considered as having a prominent place. And then just a short time later, the offering of of things to this woman at the well who would have been considered the low of the low in society at the time. We have these two different people where Jesus confirms it doesn't matter who you are, it matters how you worship, and that is worshiping after me in spirit and in truth. So in her question is, who is right? Who are the true worshipers? Who has it right by virtue of having the correct location? Who are the people of God? And for John, he always expresses things a little bit differently than Matthew, Mark, or Luke. He has a different kind of language that he uses to describe the same sort of things. So when Matthew says, the ones who do the will of my Father, those are the ones who are part of my unfolding kingdom or who are part of Jesus' family. And I would submit out there that Jesus, when he says worship in spirit and in truth, he's saying the same thing. The ones who do the will of my Father, the one who follows after me, the one who lives in the life that I'm revealing to you through my deeds and my actions and my words. So John is saying through Jesus in this story to be born of the Spirit and to worship in spirit and in truth. And that's the way one joins into God's family. That's how one is a true worshiper. And to wrap up my talk about spirit, and if you forgot that I was talking about spirit, it's okay, because I actually took a break right here in writing my notes from Thursday to Friday. And when I came back on Friday, I added this subheading spirit again, because I'd forgotten that I was, the lines before that I was talking about spirit. So if you're thinking, oh yeah, he is talking about spirit, it's all right, I did the same thing and deleted the subheading and inserted this little rabbit trail. Anyway. Yeah, so spirit. In John 4:24, God is spirit, is this statement. And this is what everything is set out upon. And this statement is that God is not limited or confined to a box or a temple. He is not containable. He is not something that's a flesh that you can just lock into a specific location, whether it be Mount Gerizim or Jerusalem. He is spirit. He can't be contained. A time is coming, indeed is here now, that the worship of God will not be defined by a temple location, but will be defined by how one worships, by following after Jesus' teaching. Last week I mentioned that, embarrassingly, I didn't finish reading all the Lord of the Rings books before I watched the movie. And I'm going to make a reference of a similar genre, and that's to Narnia. And Narnia is not the case. I'd read the books a long time. I think in grade 8 was the first time I read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But before Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe came out in 2007, I think, Leona and I decided we're going to read it together so to prepare ourselves for the movie, which often creates disappointment, unfortunately, when movies are made. But Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe didn't disappoint me. Anyway, I remember this vividly of us trying to finish the story before watching it that night, and I was driving Leona to work, and it was a particularly wintry winter in Toronto that year, and we got stuck on the side of the road because it was too snowy, and we're kind of at this corner waiting for an accident to be cleared or something, and so God presented enough time for us to read the story beforehand and not have to sit in the movie theater quickly pounding through. But in any case, in the movie, right at the end, you have Tumnus standing with Lucy, and you see Aslan walking away, and then she's kind of wishing that he would stay, and then Tumnus says to her, you can't contain him because he's not a tame lion. And I just checked the book. Beaver is actually the one who says it in the book, and he says, you mustn't press him. He is wild, you know, not a tame lion. And by focusing in on God at either Mount Gerizim or Jerusalem, people were like, focusing in on this sort of one place, but you can't contain God. He's not containable in one thing. Just like in the story of Narnia, Aslan's not containable to that one location. You can't force him to stay because he bursts out of that area and he has to move out. It's not an exact analogy, but it's how it made me think when I was thinking about this. So God is spirit. It's his character. It's who he is, who Jesus is. He's not containable. He is... can't be put in one location. So worshiping in spirit is to become what we worship. It's to become who God is. It's to become who God is as revealed in Jesus Christ, and that's what worshiping in spirit and in truth is. And truth has the idea of faithfulness. This is actually how it's translated, the first two occurrences in John in the New Living Translation. Faithfulness, integrity, honestly, dealing honestly. And this is also a common theme throughout the Gospels that Jesus, through the Spirit, will reveal all truth to people, and this Holy Spirit after will reveal all truth to people. It's not about where you are by virtue of power or position or birthright. It's about worshiping God in spirit and in truth. As I've been saying, worship is not tied to a place. It's also not tied to a specific event. It's about a manner of life that transcends the place and transcends any ritual attached to it. It's about the character of Jesus being bursting forth, not being contained within our lives in a safe pace, but pushing us out into the world to live in spirit and truth, reflecting God's glory. As many of you know, I'm sort of on this David Fitch kind of reading trip. I have two books of his on the go at the moment. And I was recently challenged just this week in his book that he co-wrote with his with the other person that he's a pastor at, Jeffrey Holsklaw, I think it is. In the book, they're talking about the mission of God. The whole book is called Prodigal Christianity, and I've really been enjoying it so far. And the way that he encourages the reader in this book to see the mission of God is to see how the mission of God, how worshiping in spirit and truth has already been unfolding in our lives and around us. Just seeing the situations that we find ourselves in as being situations where we're bringing redemption and bringing God's glory and bringing reconciliation and justice to these situations, and just having the eyes to see it, having the sensitivity to pray for it, having the sensitivity and wisdom to respond to situations where we can offer, like Jesus did to the woman at the well, water, living water, engaging in these conversations and in these times of interaction where we can be what Jesus was for the woman at the well here. And perhaps the metaphor breaks down a little bit because he was just passing through at this time. He wasn't just dwelling at the well. It wasn't the location he already found himself in. But it also works because he could have, like many Jewish people, avoided Samaria. He could have went the easy route, not embracing a situation where there could have been tension, and tension would have been even expected. Or he could have said, "Please, disciples, don't leave me here while you're going to get food." But instead, Jesus made himself available. He made himself ready for this discussion, this interaction with the woman who needed the life-giving water that he offered for herself. So, yeah, and David Fitch in this section encouraged us just to see what's going on around us. And one example that I thought of from my own life and Leona's life with me is that in Germany, there was this woman who was part of our small group, and we didn't know her particularly well as far as her journey. But it became apparent after a few kind of breakdowns that she was struggling with mental illness. And I don't remember the exact diagnosis, but it was a form of schizophrenia. And we, by virtue of actually living in the building just opposite of hers, we were pulled into this situation. We were pulled into this opportunity, which was really stressful and really was more than we could actually felt like we could handle at times. But it was this opportunity where we were able to offer living water to her by meeting with her, by dealing as a bridge between her and the church. And there was a lot of people who just didn't know how to deal with this situation. So we were involved in the middle of this. And it was just sitting with her between midnight and 4 a.m. at the emergency, saying, helping her to make the decision to get help and to start dealing with this. So God thrust us into this situation, into this well water situation, where we're able to offer living water, even though, quite honestly, we're like, "Oh, this is really tough. This is more than we can handle." But it was an opportunity where the mission of God, the situation of dealing with people who are struggling, was just right around us, was only a few feet away. So sometimes there's people that God puts in our path, who puts us where we're sitting at a well, we're sitting somewhere, and we're in our workplaces, in our jobs, in our extracurricular activities, in our children's dance or hockey teams or whatever, where they need the cup of living water, and we have the opportunity to offer that. We have the opportunity to say, we know the source of life-giving water, water that repeats in and amongst the soul of a person so that their thirst can truly be quenched, so we may reflect the character of God for these people. I had originally in the overall framing of the message, I'd hoped to talk about hope tonight, and I didn't exactly do that, except for in this woman at the well story, there's an expectation, there's a longing for something greater. And her question, in the way that she responds to this question, just which leads up to Jesus' great statement that he is the Messiah, when he says, I am the Messiah, she makes this comment of hope and anticipation and expectation, where she says, I know the Messiah is coming, the one who is called the Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. You see in those words that she had a hope, she had an anticipation that there would be somebody who would eventually fill this role. And Jesus says, I'm here now. I am. Your hope, the longing that you have for life is present here. It's right in front of you, and I'm offering you the life-giving water. The water that fills the soul. The water that enables someone to worship in spirit and in truth, to reflect Jesus' love. If you're following the newly minted blog on our webpage, you saw that I put our inaugural blog post of me actually writing something up there. And I mentioned John Vanian, how I would have used his transition to the table, and I'm actually going to use something that came from his book here that stuck out to me and struck me. And he cites Romans 8:14 to 17. And I'm actually going to continue on just a little bit further, all the way to verse 25. Because it ties in with this idea of waiting and longing for the answer to the question of who are the people of God? Who are they? Who are we? And our task is as we wait. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. So you have not received the Spirit that makes you fearful slaves. Instead, you received God's Spirit, and he adopted you as his own children. Now we call him Abba, Father, for his Spirit joins with our spirit to affirm that we are God's children. And since we are his children, we are his heirs. In fact, together with Christ, we are heirs of God's glory. But if we are to share his glory, we must also share his suffering. Yet what we suffer now is nothing compared to the glory he will reveal to us later. For all creation is waiting eagerly for that future day when God will reveal who his children really are. Against its will, all creation was subjected to God's curse. But with eager hope, the creation looks forward to the day when it will join God's children in glorious freedom from death and decay. For we all know that all creation has been groaning in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. And we believers also groan, even though we have the Holy Spirit within us as a foretaste of future glory. For we long for our bodies to be released from sin and suffering. We too wait with eager hope for the day when God will give our full rights as his adopted children, including the new bodies he has promised. We were given this hope when we were saved. If we already have something, we don't need to hope for it. But we look forward to something we don't have, yet must wait patiently and confidently. As children of God, as those who seek to live, work, and worship in spirit and in truth, we're in this time where this in-between time, the time where we know the hope, the fulfillment of the hope that we're longing for, but we're also caught in this time of wrestling where we need the restorative water of God daily as we seek to live in spirit and in truth. And it's this time that we are called to, as we live in this hope, to also take on what Jesus did for us, to take on the suffering as Paul describes here of Jesus. And in that, that's putting ourselves in situations where we can meet the needs of others. We're putting ourselves into situations where we meet someone who is thirsty at a well, and we can offer them a drink, even though Jesus starts with saying, can I have a drink? But engaging in the conversation, saying, no, we know the source of living water. We have found this hope, and even though we're in this process of hoping for everything to come together, we're just working it out, we can come alongside people and see the mission of God unfolding in their lives and in our lives. And I framed the table in a similar way last week, as the table is what comes, what brings us together, what restores our energy, what restores our life, what causes, or the symbol of what quenches our thirst. It's also the symbol of the hope that we have in Jesus for those who want to identify themselves as followers of God, who want to identify themselves as worshipers, who worship in spirit and in truth. We come to the table and we allow it to nourish our souls, to remember the death of Jesus Christ, but also then going out the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which is the life-giving water.